Would you just bow your hearts and your heads with me? Father, I thank you for the technology that allows us to gather virtually. It's not the way that most of us would prefer to gather. And I know it is a way that is going to be filled with even more distractions than normal. But I do pray for the next few moments as I speak to an empty auditorium, as everyone who is gathered this morning in their homes, offices, or wherever they are. God, I pray that though the distance is great, that your Spirit would minister to each of us. God, I pray that you would take my words and that you would use them to encourage, to comfort, and yes, maybe even convict each of us. And then, God, I pray that you would use us this week to be lights and examples of your love to a lost world that needs your love. Just bless our time together, for it's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. What is the most humble experience you've ever had done for you? Not the humblest thing you've ever done, but the humblest thing that's ever been done for you. It's pretty easy for me to name mine. It took place on December 31st, 1989. Now, I know 1989 is a long time ago, but it was the year I graduated from seminary, and it was really an important year in my life. I graduated from seminary and had this incredible privilege to go teach and live in the nation of India. I was teaching in a Bible college, 300-400 kids there, and had the incredible privilege of using a lot of the things I had just studied to help them grow in their walk. But India couldn't be more different than the United States, than Minnesota that I grew up in. It was a completely different climate. When I was there, it was hot, it was dry, it was green, it was just very different. But the biggest difference was cultural. And there was no time that that became more obvious than over the Christmas season. I had originally only planned to stay for 3 months, but the school was in desperate need of teachers, and I didn't really have a ministry to go back to, and I was enjoying myself so much, I agreed to teach the second semester. Well, there were 2 weeks between the two semesters, as there are in a lot of schools here in the States, and that was the only chance I ever really had to do any sightseeing, to be a tourist in India. It was also a chance for me to experience a lot of those differences. Christmas in the States is one of my favorite times of the year. It's usually winter, so there's snow on the ground. There's everywhere you look, everywhere you listen, constant reminders of Jesus coming to earth. And it's just an incredible chance. In fact, just this week, my daughter asked me what I was most looking forward to in Christmas. And I tried to remind her, we don't celebrate Christmas till December. Well, in India, they didn't celebrate it at all. And so it was just very different. But it was also a chance for me to experience some of the different diseases India has. In between Christmas and New Year's, which is a huge holiday, I got sick. I don't know what I had. It was probably amoebic dysentery, but it came with a fever. It came with stomach problems. It came with all of the aches and pains of whatever virus I was enduring. I was speaking every Sunday night at church, and this year, New Year's Eve fell on a Sunday. And there were huge festivities. In fact, the student body had built a bonfire in the very center of the college courtyard. They had all kinds of activities planned. It was going to be a huge, fun night that I really wanted to enjoy. But first, I had to get through the Sunday evening service. In reality, I probably should have just admitted I was sick and not spoke, but I guess I was too proud to do so. So with a little bit of Pepto-Bismol, aspirin, and a whole lot of adrenaline, I made it through the service. But as I finished speaking, I was sick. I went up to the room I was staying in, and I just collapsed on my bed. I thought maybe if I could catch an hour of sleep, maybe I would feel better. But my head was pounding, my stomach was turning, my body was aching, and I finally decided there's just no way. I'm going to have to skip the festivities. I got undressed and climbed under the sheets, and no sooner had I done that than I was as violently ill as I can remember. I couldn't make it to the bathroom. I barely got out of bed before the fountains of the deep came forth. Now I was depressed. I'm laying in my bed in a room covered in vomit, knowing I can't let it set on the floor, but not certain I had the strength to clean it up, when a knock came at the door. Dr. Alan Ironside was a Canadian missionary who served some four terms teaching at the Bible College. He was the vice president and actually was in charge of the Bible College as the president was in the States raising some funds. He had come to check on me. Evidently, I didn't look all that great when I was speaking, and he wanted to make sure I was okay. And as soon as he opened the door, he was greeted to a terrible stench and a clear story that I was sick. And he could have easily gone and got one of the servants who worked at the school. He could have gone and got some of the students. He could have gone and got many people to help him, but I'll never forget Dr. Ironside rolling up his sleeves and cleaning up my mess and caring for me when I was too sick to do so for myself. I have more than once looked back on that experience and wondered, if roles had been reversed, would have I had the humility to clean up after him? This morning, we're going back to the Gospel of John. And I have to be honest, that was a tough decision for me. We, back in February, began a look at the book of Romans, and it's an incredible study. The book of Romans is maybe one of the greatest books ever written in the history of humanity, and I decided that virtually it was going to be hard to go through it, and so we set Romans aside to go through the Gospel of John. And then once we came back, it just didn't feel right to stop halfway in the gospel. And so we finished that very first book of John. If you remember, we divided the Gospel of John into the two books, the book of the signs and the book of the glory. And a couple weeks ago, we finished up chapter 12. And I thought this would be a good time to return back to the book of Romans. But as we've now returned to virtual, I know it's just for a couple weeks, I decided that I really want to finish the Gospel of John. I have fallen in love, maybe re-fallen in love, as I enjoyed it so much when we went through it 10, 12 years ago. But I decided that I would like to finish our look at the Gospel of John. John begins with this incredible introduction to who Jesus is, and as clear and as careful of terms possible, John describes his deity. He says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." That is separate, but with God. But not only was he with God, he was God. And so John sets out in the first 12 chapters to defend that deity of Christ. He sets out to prove that Jesus is, in fact, God. And he does so by presenting these signs. And we went through those signs. He begins with the first sign in chapter 2 of turning water into wine, fulfilling the Genesis 48 prophecy that when Messiah comes, wine will be as commonplace as water. He then gives the foreshadowing of his greatest miracle. He predicts that after he has been dead 3 days, he will rise from the dead. He then goes on and he heals an official's son. He heals a man who's been lame for 38 years. He feeds the multitude. And then in chapter 9, he gives sight to the blind. But it's in chapter 12 where, without question, Jesus demonstrates his deity as he goes to Bethany, where Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. And simply with the power of his words, he brings Lazarus back from the dead. There is no doubt that Jesus has proved supernatural power. And he's claimed to be God. Now, I know some in our society today would suggest that Jesus never claimed deity, that he was only assigned that by the church many years later. But I don't think you can read John and come to that conclusion. We could go to several places, but let me just go to one in chapter 10, that great Good Shepherd passage. It ends with the religious leaders enraged at Jesus. In fact, John describes it this way: the Jews picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus said to them, "I've shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me?" And their response is very clear. "We're not arguing you've done miracles. we're not stoning you for any of these miracles. We'll give you, you have miraculous supernatural power. But what we're stoning you for is for blasphemy. Because you, a mere man, they would agree that Jesus was human, are claiming to be God. They didn't miss it. They understood Jesus' claims. He claimed to be God because he was and is God. But sadly, John is going to sum up the first book with some of the saddest words ever written. As he comes near the end of chapter 12, he's going to say, even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs, no one doubted his signs. He had performed them. But even after he had done all of these signs in a public fashion, they still would not believe in him. And thus, Jesus' public ministry is done. He's finished doing miracles for the masses, feeding the multitude, speaking and sharing his love to a large gathering. But John is not quite finished with the story. If all we had were the Synoptic Gospels, we might conclude that Jesus' ministry was just a single year because Matthew, Mark, and Luke only share one Passover. It's John's Gospel that we see there are actually four Passovers shared. The first begins the ministry, and the last is the Passover we'll be at in a second. But if you look at these first 11 chapters of the Gospel of John, they take place over a series of 3+ years. And John fairly rapidly makes his way through those 3 years. And then he slows down. In fact, John is going to slow down and take a look at this amazing week. In fact, John chapter 12 is going to take place over several days. It begins on Saturday and ends someplace on Wednesday, certainly before Thursday. And then John is going to slow down even more. In fact, John chapter 13 to 17 is going to take place in about a 12-hour window. This is going to be the upper room discourse. It's going to follow with this amazing trip out into the garden. And he doesn't share all of the details of the Garden of Gethsemane like the synoptics do. But he shares this great, incredible high priestly prayer as Jesus prays for his disciples. And he prays for you and for me, any who will follow in the words of the disciples. He prays for us. And then chapter 18 and 19 will take place the rest of the day on Friday as he will be betrayed, he will be arrested, he will be killed. And by the end of chapter 19, he'll be laid in the grave. It is these chapters between chapter 13 and chapter 19 that I want to spend the remainder of our year looking at. I want to look at this amazing demonstration of his love. John introduces the story this way, that it was the Passover feast. The Passover was one of those pilgrimage feasts where all of the Jewish males were expected to be in the city of Jerusalem. And as they came to the city, John shares that Jesus now knows that his time has come. The time, that is, for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. And then he shares, having loved his own who were in the world, he showed them the full extent of his love. Love is one of those words that we hear a great deal about. You can't turn on the radio without hearing a song about love. But for our society, love tends to be this ooey-gooey emotional or this physical love. But what is love? Well, John is going to very clearly answer that question in his first epistle. In chapter 3, in verse 16, he's going to say, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. The ultimate description of love is what Jesus will do in chapter 19 when he gives his life for us. And John is going to say, ultimately, love is the willingness to sacrifice your life for those that you love. But let's be honest. You get one chance at that. You can only lay down your life once. You only get to die once. So is love only dying? John says, no, no. If you have material possessions and you see your brother in need but have no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us love not with words or tongue, but with the actions and with truth. See, what Jesus is doing in chapters 13 through chapter, really the end of the gospel, chapter 21, he is going to show us what love looks like. And it's all going to begin with this amazing story. One of the reasons why I was tempted to jump back to the gospel of, or to the book of Romans, is because we've been in John chapter 13. I think this is my fourth or fifth time to speak from John chapter 13. And I was a little reluctant because you have heard everything I have to say on the chapter. And yet the more I thought about it, there are some stories in the Bible that can't just be left alone. You heard it once, that's the end of it. I mean, every year we celebrate Christmas. Every year we celebrate Easter, and rightfully we should. Those are huge events. They're events we can't forget. Jesus came. Jesus died. Jesus rose from the dead. And the more I thought about it, yes, we've gone to John 13 in the past. But this is one of the most beautiful pictures of what love looks like. What does love in action and truth look like? I don't know that there's too many better illustrations than John 13. So this morning, as we begin this new study, I really would like to just let Lumo read for you the first part of John chapter 13.
It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel round his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped round him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." Jesus answered, "Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said, "Not everyone was clean." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. I am not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen. But this is to fulfill this passage of Scripture. He who shared my bread has turned against me.
Let me just share with you this morning five characteristics I see of Jesus' love in this passage. The first one's pretty easy to miss. Verse number one says that Jesus knew his time had come. He then in verse number two says that Judas has been indwelt by Satan and is now committed to betraying Jesus. But then verse number three is this incredible reminder of who Jesus is and what Jesus is about to endure. He begins by saying Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Only one person in all the universe has all things under his power. This pandemic is constantly reminding me how few things I have under my power. If it were up to me, we'd be together this morning in a huge gathering of unity and love. But we're not. Why? Because many things aren't in my control. But Jesus was in power and control over everything. Nothing that's about to happen happens by accident. Nothing that's about to happen overtakes Jesus. No. He willingly offers his life for you and for me. But what John reminds us is that he fully knew what was about to happen. Jesus was about to endure the most painful 24 hours any human being has ever been asked to endure. He was going to be betrayed by one of his closest friends. The rest of his friends would abandon him. He would then be taken and his nation would fail him as he would unjustly be convicted of a crime he clearly hadn't committed. He'd be turned over to the Romans where he would be subjected to intense and inhumane punishment. He would be beaten. He would be mocked. He would be made fun of. He would then be taken and nailed to a tree. The Romans had spent years investigating and studying and trying to find the most torturous way to kill a person. And they had perfected it in crucifixion. It was the most excruciating death anyone could endure. But as horrific as all of that was, his emotional turmoil of being betrayed and abandoned, his physical pain of being beaten and crucified, none of it compares to the spiritual torment of having to endure the punishment I deserve, that you deserve. For in that moment in time, Jesus paid the punishment that our sins deserved. An eternity of torment for all of us. Jesus suffered in that moment. And he knew it was coming. Be honest. When you feel crummy, when you have pressures upon you, are you your most loving? I guess this is confession time with Pastor Dan, but I think most of you know that I have had COVID. I was diagnosed a couple weeks ago with it and was officially set free of my isolation earlier in the week. But I haven't felt the best. And if I'm honest, I haven't been the most pleasant to be around. I must admit, when I don't feel very good, sometimes I get a little cranky. Now, I'm sure none of you ever have fallen prey to this, but sometimes I'm not as loving as I should be, which was true the last couple weeks. Jesus is about to endure something infinitely worse than I went through. Than anything you've gone through. And yet, regardless of his personal struggles, Jesus still loved. I hope you don't miss this. John chapter 13 is this incredible reminder that at the worst of his life, Jesus still loved. It's a reminder to me, it's a conviction to me that even when I don't feel my best, even when the pressures of life are overwhelming, I still have a responsibility, a need to love those God has placed in my life. Jesus did. The second quality is also somewhat hidden, but I think really important. Jesus acts unannounced. Let me try and set the context. It's Passover. Now, I know that Passover doesn't mean a lot to most of us. Many of you had the privilege of having a Passover Seder with us a couple years ago. Around the Easter time, we went downstairs, we had a Passover Seder, and I tried my best to explain what the different elements were. But the reality is we spent about 30 to 60 minutes downstairs, ate the meal. A true Passover Seder is a 4 or 5 hour event. It's a huge event. In the first century, it was an even bigger event. The first century, Passover was kind of the mixture of the 4th of July, that national fervor and excitement, Thanksgiving, the biggest meal of the year, and Christmas, where there were all these festivities. It was kind of all those three holidays thrown together in one. Now, it doesn't seem possible to me, but Thanksgiving's only a little over a month away. We'll be gathered together as families, I'm assuming, sitting at a table. And I want you to imagine that you're at Thanksgiving dinner, this huge festivities, all of your family's there. There's a huge group. The turkey's placed on the table. Dad has cut away the slices. And suddenly, everything stops. Jesus sees this need, and he simply acts. He gets up and he cares for their needs. He doesn't announce what he's about to do. Several years ago, I remember visiting with somebody who made what I thought was a really astute point, one that I can relate to, maybe you can. They made the comment that they don't mind serving others, but they really don't like to be treated like a servant. See, most of us are okay to do some pretty humble things if we know other people are watching. If you will, if we know we're going to get credit for it. We oftentimes will do some really humble things. In fact, one of the interesting things to me is this foot washing that Jesus is about to do has grown into a ceremony that some churches practice, that the leaders of the church, the pastor and the leaders, will bring people up to the front of the church and wash their feet while other people are watching. Jesus doesn't do this in a public forum. He doesn't wash the feet of the disciples when the masses are watching. He doesn't do it. He doesn't call the Jerusalem Post and say, hey, you need to send a reporter. I've got something they want to report. No, he just acts. The Pharisees were notorious for acting in public fashions. They did some humble things too, but they wanted to make sure everybody was watching. It reminds me of the pastor who came up with this incredible sermon on humility. He was convinced it was the best sermon he'd ever prepared. But as he was getting ready to share it on Sunday, he decided there weren't enough people in church, so he'd save it for a time more people could hear it. That's kind of the way we oftentimes approach this humility, this love stuff. I'm willing to serve you as long as others are watching, but serve in a fashion that almost nobody sees? In a fashion I get no credit for it? Are you sure about that? That's how Jesus does it. He gets up in the middle of the meal and he takes off his outer garments and he wraps a towel around his waist. And then he pours the water into a basin and he begins to wash the feet of his disciples, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. The third part of this act is Jesus meets the needs of those around him. Some of the needs were pretty obvious. In the first century, particularly in Palestine, there were basically no paved roads. In Palestine, because of the hot climate, generally people wore sandals, if shoes at all. And the combination of the high heat, the dusty conditions, the sweaty, smelly feet mixing with the dust of the road made some pretty dirty feet and smelly feet. But to make matters even worse, there wasn't the modern sanitation. There wasn't a garbage man who picked up the garbage. Most of the way things were transported was by ox-drawn carts or by donkeys. And so you can imagine the garbage and leftovers of the animals in the street. It was really common that your feet would get really dirty. In fact, I'm told in the first century, you almost never entered someone's house with your shoes on. You would, before you entered, take your shoes off. And usually, there would be a basin, a little pool of water, that at some of the nicer homes, they might hire somebody to wash your feet. At a really accommodating place, they might wash your feet. But at the very bare minimum, you would wash your feet. We're going to see in a second that pool was available. But none of the disciples did it. In fact, they enter the room with dirty feet. Jesus sees their dirty feet and he acts. But I must admit, I was really struck by a thought. This is something that maybe going through the gospel really impacted me, because I hadn't really thought about it. If I can go back to my handy dandy chart. If you remember, chapter 13 takes place on Thursday afternoon evening. If you could just go back a few days, 5 days to be exact, you have one of the most beautiful acts anywhere in the Gospels when Jesus is sitting down at a meal with his disciples. Mary comes and she breaks this alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume and she washes the feet of Jesus. Now, this story is shared with us a couple other times. There's some debate as to whether or not it's the same story. We don't know for certain. Almost certainly Matthew's is. Many would say that Luke's wasn't. But it certainly conjured up the story in Luke. And in Luke's story, the Pharisee who was sitting at the head of the table sees the woman washing Jesus' feet and he's offended by it. And so Jesus responds with this parable, and then he concludes by saying, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house, and you did not give me any water for my feet." Jesus said, "You insulted me by not giving me water to wash my feet. But this woman, she's wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair." It's an incredible demonstration. Jesus had a need, and she went to unimagined lengths to wash his feet. How do you forget that in 5 days? I mean, the disciples, okay, maybe you don't wash the fellow bums, the other disciples' feet. Maybe you say, "No way, I'm not washing your feet, Peter. They're too smelly, they're too dirty." But how does no one wash Jesus' feet? I must admit, I was really perplexed at that. The disciples have already forgotten the lesson from 5 days ago. I wonder how often I forget lessons. I wonder how often you do. They should have known better, but they don't. Why? Well, I think you get a hint that what Jesus is about to do is bigger than simply washing their feet. If you go back to Mark's account, as the disciples are heading to Jerusalem for that final week, there is an argument that breaks out. James and John ask Jesus, "Can I be your first and your second? Can I be your right and your left when you come into your kingdom?" And soon the other disciples find out about it, and an argument breaks out. "How could you ask that, John? You're not worthy of the position." And a dispute breaks out, and Jesus quiets them, and he says, "No, the Son of Man didn't come into the world to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Well, they then come into the upper room. And Luke shares with us a few details that John doesn't. In chapter 22 of the Gospel of Luke, we read, "In the same way after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This is the cup, this is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you.'" He institutes the Lord's Supper. Interestingly enough, John doesn't share that part of the upper supper. the upper room discourse, nothing about communion, the Lord's Supper, is talked about. But in Luke, he goes on to say, but the hand of him who's going to betray me is with me on the table. The Son of Man will go as it has been decreed, but woe to the man who betrays him. And as soon as the disciples find out that one of them will betray him, they begin to argue. But notice where the argument goes. It goes back to the discussion from earlier in the week. A dispute breaks out over who is the greatest. They were arguing about who is the most important. See, I'm convinced that what the problem was not just that they had dirty feet, but that they were convinced they were better than the guy sitting next to them. In fact, as Jesus goes on to try and give an instruction from it, I don't believe he's starting a third ordinance. I don't believe the upper room had both the Lord's Supper and foot washing as an ordinance. No, I think the foot washing was something more important, more basic. He's going to say when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. And do you understand what I've done for you? He asked them. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightfully so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you should also wash one another's feet. I have set an example that you should do as I have done. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is the messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. Jesus' point is this. You need to serve those around you. You need to meet the needs of others and not consider yourself better than others. See, I'm convinced what Jesus does is he illustrates what it truly means to love. See, Jesus saw their need, and he wanted them to understand how important it is to meet the needs of those around us. Not thinking of yourself higher than them, but thinking of ways you can help them. In fact, thinking about how you can help all of them. John is really careful as he paints the picture that all 12 disciples were there. In fact, we're going to next week look at Jesus' new command to love one another. We're going to look at the betrayal of Judas. And Jesus will send Judas out of the room, but not until he's washed his feet. Be honest, when somebody offends you, how easy is it to show love to them? When someone really hurts you, intentionally, viciously, how easy is it to love them? No one has ever betrayed anyone as badly as Judas did the perfect, sinless Son of God for a few pieces of silver. And yet Jesus washed his feet. Abraham Lincoln is arguably one of the greatest presidents our nation has ever had. And I think one of the reasons is because he was such an incredibly humble man. There are many stories that are told of his willingness to put the needs of others in front of his own. I came across one in 1862. Edwin Stanton became the Secretary of War. And General Stanton was now in charge of the Union's war effort to reunite the nation. And Abraham Lincoln brought with a couple of other members of the cabinet and went to General Stanton's house wanting to discuss the war effort. When they arrived, they found out that General Stanton was off to a wedding. Well, even though the president had many things he could be doing and probably even a number of things he should be doing, he decided to wait. And they waited roughly an hour in General Stanton's parlor. Finally, the general came, and as he entered the house, he saw the president in the parlor and proceeded to go upstairs. About 10 minutes later, one of his servants came down and announced, "General Stanton has gone to bed for the evening. He will not be inviting and entertaining any guests." Well, the two people that were with President Lincoln were enraged. They thought about running upstairs and dragging the general out of bed when President Lincoln said, no, no. If General Stanton can bring us victory, now is not the time to worry about the finer points of etiquette. The reality is that President Lincoln was willing to overlook the faults of those who attacked him if they could reunite the Union. Eventually, General Stanton would become a staunch ally of the president, and he was won because President Lincoln loved even those who attacked him. Jesus loved even Judas. I wonder, do we? There's one final quality that I don't want to miss. It's kind of hidden in here, and it's easy to miss, but I think it really is a pretty important part of the story. If you remember, when Jesus goes and he starts to wash the feet of the disciples, we don't know the order, but it doesn't seem as if Peter is first. He comes to Peter, and as soon as he comes to Peter, Peter says, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus responds to him and he says, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. I think what Peter is insinuating is, I am not going to let you wash my feet. I don't have that great of a need. See, I think one of the hardest parts of the story for me is love is not only the willingness to serve others, it is the willingness to allow others to serve us. I have to be honest, and I kind of wish that I could take a survey right now. We're on Facebook. Maybe I should ask you to vote in the comments column. I won't, but if you want to, go ahead. Which is easier for you, to serve or be served? See, if it was all about foot washing, I would be happy to wash 10, 20, 100 feet before I want my feet washed. It's easy for me to serve. I should say easier. I'm as selfish as the next guy. I don't always like to be put out to help others, but I think that's way easier than having to receive help. I was reminded of that last week. Let me just give you a little bit of background. Last Monday, I began the week like I normally do. I had been diagnosed COVID positive. We were in isolation, but I figured I was going to speak last Sunday, so on Monday I started looking at the passage. As I had spoke on it before, so I went back and I listened to one of my sermons to try and get my thought process headed in the right direction, preparing for Sunday. Later in the day, Renee and I were having a discussion, and she said, so are you preaching this Sunday? I said, well, of course I'm preaching. She says, but you have COVID. You're sick. Let me give you a little bit of background to the way I grew up. Both my mom and my dad have had chronic illnesses the entire time I've known them. My mom was diagnosed with Crohn's disease when she was just a little girl. My father was diagnosed with myasthenia gravis when he was a freshman in college. Both of them can be debilitating diseases at times, but neither one of them would ever really let their diseases stop them. They were going to go on and continue. And my guess is many people had no idea that my parents were sick because they would just grin and bear it. And so I figured that's what I'm going to do. Come on, it's virtual. I'm sitting in an empty auditorium with three cameras pointed at me right now. You don't know when I'm recording this. They won't know when I'm recording this. And in COVID, for me, I know that a number of you have had it, as we talked about earlier. For me, it was kind of the weirdest cold I've ever had. Normally a cold, I start it coming on, it gets worse and worse, and then I feel miserable, and then it gets better. This was much more, I felt fine for a few hours, and then suddenly this wave would come over me, and I'd have to go to bed. And it's true that maybe last week I would have had to stop in the middle of the taping and go home and sleep for an hour, but then I could come back and splice it together, and I'll bet you wouldn't have ever noticed. And she said, Renee said, but you're sick. Maybe you just need to be humble enough to admit you need help. As she's saying that, in the back of my head, screaming loudly, is John 13. Should we change your name to Peter? Are you telling Jesus, no, you can't wash my feet? Well, as hard as it was for me to do, if you watch last week, you know Paul spoke, and I am most appreciative of him doing it. But even more than his willingness to do it was the lesson that I need to learn, that there are times when I just need to be willing to allow others to serve me. Many of you did just that while my family was sick. I want to thank you and praise you for your kindness to bring meals to my house. Many of you were willing to reach out to my family and see if you could pick up groceries. We were quarantined. We couldn't go to the grocery store. And several of you bought things and brought them to my house. And many more of you offered. And I want to praise you for your willingness to serve. But it was an incredible lesson to me on the importance of receiving that service. John chapter 13 has a number of incredible lessons, but I hope you take at least one of them from this. And let me leave you just with one clear application. How can you help someone this week? I know that COVID has brought us into a unique time in which it's harder than ever to find ways to help others. You can't run off to the nursing home and spend some time with somebody there. They won't let you in. You can't go to the hospital. It's hard to even sometimes connect with other people as this social distancing is pushed on us. But I want to challenge you that Jesus lays out this incredible illustration of what love looks like, that no matter how I feel, no matter what others have done to me, I see the needs and meet them. I would ask you to prayerfully consider, Lord, will you give me one person, one tangible act this way, that I can serve someone this week? I hope that you will do that. Would you just bow your hearts and your heads with me once again in prayer? God, I thank you for the chance to gather in this very unique way. I thank you for your Son, for his ultimate service he gives to us by dying for us, but his continual service that he gives in cleansing us. God, I do pray that each of us would find a way to live that life of service this week, and that we would meet the needs of someone for your glory and your honor. For it is in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.